Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, April 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, tensions rise over U.S. airstrikes in Syria as the U.S. Secretary of State heads to Moscow.
The real failure here has been Russia's failure to live up to its commitments under the chemical weapons agreements that were entered into in 2013.
Growing outrage after the viral video of a man physically removed from a U.S. airplane.
My God, what are you doing?
Also ahead, the latest social media lawsuits. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the White House continues to defend its decision to authorize airstrikes on a Syrian military base. Spokesman Sean Spicer also says the administration isn't ruling out doing it again.
The sight of people being gassed and blown away by barrel bombs ensures that if we see this kind of action again, we hold open the possibility of future action.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is heading to Moscow for talks with Russian leaders amid a spike in tensions over those attacks in Syria. Tillerson has expressed disappointment at Moscow's inability to account for all of Syria's chemical weapons under a 2013 agreement following last week's attack, allegedly by the forces of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Now, before his visit to Russia, he did stop in Italy for a G7 meeting. VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, traveling with Tillerson, tells International Edition Sarah Williams there's a bit of concern over what's next for how the U.S. plans to deal with Syria.
The Italians are very interested in trying to prevent any sort of further escalation after the surprising U.S. military strikes on the Syrian airfield last week. And Secretary Tillerson did visit an Italian war memorial Monday, a World War II memorial where Nazis massacred more than 500 civilians. And he said that the U.S. wants to rededicate itself to holding account anyone who commits crimes against innocence anywhere in the world. So I believe U.S. allies are a bit puzzled as to what those Syrian airstrikes mean and what the U.S. position is.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because what is the response toward that? I mean, it seems like British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson supports the U.S. action, but what are some of the reaction from some of the other foreign ministers?
Well, there did seem to be at least understanding from Germany and other countries about saying that basically Assad had brought that on himself and he was brutally attacking civilians, so he was responsible for what happened to him. But they're also at the same time, Germany, for example, reemphasized that political negotiations, political peace talks are needed. And also the other countries are also trying to give the U.S. support, give Secretary Tillerson support for his talks in Russia. He will be leaving Italy and going straight to Moscow. And the other countries are very interested in saying, look, Russia needs to stop propping up the Syrian President Assad.
Yes, Secretary Tillerson's his next stop will be Moscow. And certainly going into these talks between Mr. Tillerson and Russian officials, that's going to be probably a pretty tense encounter, I would think, particularly following these Syrian airstrikes.
Yes, I think so too, Sarah, to the point where we're not even sure now whether Secretary Tillerson will be meeting with Russian President Putin or just with his counterpart, the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov. And the Kremlin is saying that, you know, no meeting was on the schedule with President Putin. But in the past, you know, former secretaries of state, usually when they go to Moscow, they do meet with President Putin. So, you know, not sure if Russia is trying to signal that it's annoyed with airstrikes or what the reason is. But it would definitely look like that it's going to be a tense meeting, and we're not sure how far Tillerson, who's had good contacts in the past as the CEO of Exxon with Russian President Putin, how hard he's going to push the Russians to stop propping up Assad.
Well, meanwhile, two new U.S. public opinion polls show Americans support President Trump's missile attacks on Syria for its use of chemical weapons, but it also shows they've got little appetite for further military action against the Assad regime. Well, the threat of force against North Korea has gained new credibility following U.S. airstrikes against Syria. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the strike was a warning to other countries, including North Korea, that a response is likely if they pose a danger.
The assessments are obviously somewhat difficult, but clearly he has made significant advancements in delivery systems, and that is what concerns us the most.
By sending a U.S. Navy strike force into waters near North Korea, President Donald Trump is raising concerns that he is prepared to put America's interests ahead of those of regional allies. Joining me now for more on this very volatile situation is Jonathan Miller, International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us. So what is your observation when it comes to the U.S. sending a warship into that region?
I see it as not a dramatic change from the United States. You know, they've sent similar deployments before, but I think it's another sign of kind of reassurance to Japan and South Korea, who are quite edgy at all the recent missile tests from the North. And clearly, I mean, the Trump administration has been saying just before Xi Jinping and China, the Chinese leader, visited the U.S., Trump signaled that the clock is running out and that if China's not going to help us, we're going to kind of go about this alone. So I think the rhetoric is definitely changing quite a bit.
The policy of this administration is a bit confusing. It seemed like during the campaign, he made it a point to say, you know, it's like, we're not the world police. We are going to put America first. Obviously, this is an important region to the U.S. Do you think that the message is clear, or do you think that this is convoluting it?
I think he's, as he said, he started with this kind of America first foreign policy, but I think he's tended to kind of moderate a little bit, especially with regards to East Asia. I mean, it was interesting. He railed against Japan and South Korea from a burden-sharing perspective that they weren't basically paying enough for host nation support. But these kind of views have moderated since he actually took office. The realities of governance have kind of hit him, at least in this region. His defense secretary went to Japan and South Korea in February and basically took a U-turn on all that stuff, saying that, especially for Japan, he says that this is the model for burden sharing the relationship. So it's seeming that he's starting to realize the value or the need of some alliances, especially, I think, with what's happening in North Korea. I think he realizes that he definitely can't handle this situation alone. My concern is that I think he's putting too much emphasis on the relationship with China. I think he thinks that this is going to be like a silver bullet or like a vaccine for the North Korean issue, and I think he's really overplaying what China can or will do.
What happens if China does nothing? I mean, do we really have anything we can do?
So that's the thing. It's like the options in North Korea are always limited. There's no real one option that I think is sufficient. I think it needs to be a continuation of, I mean, they need to have a stronger approach through deterrence. I mean, through some of the activities such as the deployment of U.S. Assistance Vinson that's in the region now. Missile defense options are going to be something that are going to continue to be discussed. The THAAD missile system is now deployed in South Korea. They might look at deploying THAAD in Japan and other missile defense options. I think greater trilateral cooperation and military exercises between Japan and South Korea will be another thing that they discuss. Those have all been kind of done, though, over the past decade to varying levels. So I think to try to do something new or try to really tighten the screws, I think they may look to put on secondary sanctions and potentially target Chinese banks that work with elements of the regime in North Korea. You know, would definitely inflame ties with China. And then you get to the kind of the most undesirable option, which would be military force, which it's tricky for a number of reasons. And I don't think that seems to be an option that makes a whole lot of sense, mainly just because we don't know the proportionality of the North Korean response. And I don't think we can accept the risk of how they might respond.
Would you say the threat from North Korea is probably one of the biggest to the U.S. and its allies?
I definitely think so. The North Korean threat is an immediate and a medium-term risk. It's a different threat than something like, for example, like China or Russia, where China is a strategic challenge, I guess, that needs to be managed. Risks need to be managed in that relationship. There's the relationship with the U.S. is so interlinked, whereas you look at North Korea, I mean, there's really no economic relationship. The relationship is really focused on the security guarantees to U.S. allies in the region. It is getting to a point that even though it has been a tense relationship for decades, I think because of the capabilities that the North have been procuring year after year, it's getting to a point where something has to budge on it. I don't think once the North Koreans are able to perfect their delivery system, their ICBM, basically, which would be to hit continental U.S., that's basically the threshold, the breaking point. So I think we're getting closer and closer to some sort of confrontation.
So you think there could actually be a confrontation?
I think that, you know, the ICBM, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. I mean, they haven't done a test of that, so let alone perfected that capability. But to me, that is an area, and I think there's a lot of experts who are speculating the ICBM is the threshold, whether it's immediately before an ICBM test or immediately after a successful ICBM test, the U.S. might take military action. But I think the interesting thing is like how that would look. I mean, would it be something that would be extremely surgical, almost similar to like a Syria model where you hit the rocket launcher or the site that basically launched the ICBM and hope for a proportional response, or whether you go quite a bit larger and you're looking at kind of regime change, which is a much messier and complex type of operation if you're going to try that.
North Korea's big on symbolism and celebrating certain anniversaries, and I know they've got one coming up. Do you think that they'll probably do something provocative pretty soon?
For sure. The pace of their provocations over the last year, I mean, it's really been unprecedented. I mean, since Kim Jong-un has taken over, been over 70 or 75 missile tests combined with nuclear tests, if you combine them both, the provocations have been ramping up consistently. They probably will signal something else in response to their kind of key anniversary days. Also, the U.S. deployment that you've just talked about at the beginning, that's another kind of thing that the North will like to respond to. And I think that they'll be, you know, it's interesting. If there was something that came out of the U.S.-China summit that was significant, against North Korea, they probably would have responded signaling to U.S. and China. But they also want to signal, you know, don't forget us, we're here. That's a very common North Korean approach, too. So, and I could see continued missile tests for sure. And they're going to have another looming nuclear test that could basically be coming any time now.
That's Jonathan Miller, International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Rex Tillerson vows a new commitment to protect civilians worldwide. U.S. polls show Americans support a missile attack on Syria, but not further military action. Serbia and United States are stepping up efforts to bolster the region's security. And researchers are close to an injection-free vaccine. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. In the White House Rose Garden, Neil Gorsuch was sworn in Monday as the 113th U.S. Supreme Court Justice, filling the seat vacated by the death of Associate Justice Antonin Scalia 14 months ago. With President Donald Trump looking on approvingly in the warm sunshine, the 49-year-old Gorsuch took the oath of office from Justice Anthony Kennedy, whom he once served as a law clerk. It's the first time a sitting justice will hear cases on the bench alongside a former clerk.
And that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform.
And that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform.
All the duties incumbent upon me,
all the duties incumbent upon me,
as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States,
as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States,
under the Constitution and laws of the United States,
under the Constitution and laws of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Well, this brings the bench to full strength, 9 members, and it restores its previous conservative ideological balance. It was the culmination of an ugly political battle that changed the workings of the Senate, damaged its reputation for collegial debate, and removed once and for all the illusion that the selection of Supreme Court justices is not political. Moments after taking the oath, the new Justice Gorsuch said he is humbled by the trust placed in him.
I will never forget that to whom much is given, much will be expected. And I promise you that I will do all my powers permit to be a faithful servant of the Constitution and laws of this great nation.
Legal scholars soon will have a chance to see Justice Gorsuch in action. when the Supreme Court meets to take up the final 13 cases of the current term. He won't be able to vote on cases brought up before he was sworn in. He may, however, have a decisive role to play when the court hears a controversial case April 19th on the extent to which the government can support religious institutions. Well, during a ceremony at UN headquarters on Monday and streamed live on Facebook and YouTube, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomed 19-year-old Nobel laureate Malala Yousafzai, calling her his hero while presenting her with another honor.
Today, I am proud to designate you the youngest ever United Nations Messenger of Peace with a special focus on girls' education. Honoring the fact that you have shown, even in the face of grave danger, an unwavering commitment to peace, conscious of your consistent focus on the best in humankind and your resolve to foster a better world.
Well, Yousafzai became an advocate for girls' education when she was just 11 years old and living under Taliban rule. Her advocacy brought retaliation from the Taliban when, at the age of 15, Yousafzai was shot in the head and seriously wounded while riding in a school bus. She was airlifted to a Pakistani military hospital and 4 days later to an intensive care unit in Birmingham, England, where she had a long recovery.
I'm really honored to be the messenger of peace. And I stood here on the stage almost 3.5 years ago when it was my 16th birthday and it was my first appearance after the attack. And I stood here and I gave my speech and I told the world that education is the basic human right of every girl and that no child should be denied this right.
Yousafzai continues to live in Britain with her parents and younger brother. It's there that she has become an international advocate for girls' education through the Malala Fund, which she runs with her father. They promote 12 years of free, safe, and quality education for girls worldwide. According to UN statistics, more than 130 million girls are out of school today. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, video of a man being dragged out of a United Airlines flight in Chicago has gone viral. According to the airline, the Sunday flight from Chicago to Louisville, Kentucky was overbooked, so the flight crew asked passengers to voluntarily take another flight. No one did volunteer, so the airline randomly chose four people. Witnesses say one man refused, saying he was a doctor who needed to get home so he could see his patients the next morning. But police then came on board and dragged him off the plane as other passengers watched in disbelief. Well, the CEO of United Airlines posted a statement on Twitter apologizing for having to reaccommodate the customers. He also said his team is moving with a sense of urgency to work with the authorities and conduct a detailed review of what happened. Joining me now to discuss this is Dallas Aviation attorney Will Angeli. It really looked very upsetting to the other passengers. It looked like the man had a bloody lip from banging his head against the armrest, too.
I think it was. You could hear from some of the audio from the passengers. You know, he wouldn't go, and they did physically just drag his body down the aisle. I'm sure that's extraordinarily upsetting. You know, we do not live in a police state. That seemed for all the world to be what that looked like on video.
As someone who is an aviation attorney, was this even legal for them to do?
It's an interesting question because the federal aviation regulations, they allow for overbooking. And it's 14 CFR 250 is the provisions that address this. And they say that you have to provide immediate compensation. But they speak in terms of if you're involuntarily denied boarding, which is interesting. And if you're involuntarily denied boarding, then, you know, you're entitled to receive a certain amount of compensation that's set forth here. And then the airline has to write a set of rules that basically follow the regulations. And United has that same set of rules, and it mocks that same language. If you're involuntarily denied boarding, if you just look at those words, that means that all of this is handled at the gate prior to anyone being allowed
right
down the jet bridge and onto the plane.
But he boarded. They allowed him to board.
He had already boarded. He was in his seat. There's nothing in either the regulations or United's rules that says we can physically restrain and remove you from an airplane after you have already taken your seat, you know, and in doing so use physical force and you know, some level of physical violence to do that. There's absolutely nothing in the regulations that gives him that sort of authority.
And the fact that they didn't want to remove him from the seat because they were overbooked at that point, they wanted to remove him so they could put their own staff in.
Yeah.
So that seems very convoluted.
It does seem very convoluted. The other part of the regulation is that, you know, if you're a passenger and you're a fare-paying passenger, you have certain rights. If you're a zero fare paying passenger, which is what the regulations, you know, talk about that in, which is, you know, like an award, a miles award sort of thing, your rights aren't as great. They can bump you more easily. But from what I've been able to ascertain, this man was a fare paying passenger who was rightfully in his seat. They took four employees of the airline who are never fare-paying passengers. They ride for free. And so these people were not fare-paying passengers, and so they were trying to bump a fare-paying passenger for an employee of the airline who wasn't paying any fare and make room for that person.
Would you expect a lawsuit to be inevitable?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Do you think this is, you know, an open and shut case, so to speak?
You know, no case is open and shut, but it's. I think the man has a very strong case, I guess. I don't really see a justifiable reason that this got as out of hand as it did. I think United was wrong to handle it the way that they handled it. There are, you know, probably 15 better ways to handle it. If he decides to pursue some sort of recourse against the airline, he would have a, you know, he'd have a good case.
And there's also been a lot of criticism of how the CEO of United Airlines responded in the statement that he made. What was your view on how he handled that?
It was a weak statement. You know, basically he, you know, he said something to the effect of, you know, he was deeply upset by having to reaccommodate the passengers aboard the flight. Well, you know, this was not a reaccommodation of passengers aboard the flight. This was, you know, one could argue this was an assault of a fare-paying passenger to physically remove him from a plane so, you know, we can get four of our employees to Kentucky so that they can catch flights in the morning. I mean, there's no justification for that. So I think it was a weak statement, to be sure.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Dallas-based aviation attorney Will Angley. Turning now to our social media segment, we are joined by Andrew Palcheski. So what is happening today in the world of social media?
Well, Lori, I hope you like lawsuits.
Oh, well, who doesn't?
Who doesn't like lawsuits, right? We've got a couple of lawsuits related to social and digital media.
Okay.
The first one is a lawsuit filed by the Department of Labor against Google. Now, this was back in January. Filed by the Department of Labor because Google is a federal contractor. The federal government has contracts with Google for various web services. So the Department of Labor filed this lawsuit about Google's pay practices to try to make sure they were complying with federal law as far as equal pay. And according to the Department of Labor and the things that were uncovered as part of this lawsuit, which are being revealed now, Google is not paying men and women equally.
Really?
So big news for one of the biggest companies in Silicon Valley.
They're supposed to be such a great company to work for, so that surprises me somewhat.
It is surprising. Google, for their part, have said that they vehemently deny and disagree with this, that they're using particular data and interpreting it in a way that would suggest that, but that's not actually part of their practice. The Department of Labor, for their part, says that as a result of these findings, they are going to move, if this continues and Google doesn't address it, to have all of their contracts with the federal government canceled, potentially a loss of a lot of money for Google. So this is not the last, I have a feeling, that we're going to hear about this story. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of back and forth and a lot of trying to parse through the data and the information, trying to figure out what the truth actually is. But as far as the Department of Labor is concerned, Google is being unjust in its pay. Google says that is not the case.
Wow. Okay. Anything else
going
on?
The other lawsuit, another lawsuit that we talked about on the show recently, that Twitter was suing the U.S. government because the U.S. government was trying to get them to reveal the identity of an account associated with Customs and Border Protection, an account apparently being run by rogue employees who were leaking information about Customs and Border Protection. Well, the federal government finally decided to drop their request for Twitter to reveal that information, and as a result, Twitter has dropped their lawsuit against the federal government. So for the time being, the identity of this account, it's at @alt_USCIS for U.S. Customs and Immigration Service. That identity of that person will remain a mystery for the time being. Whether the government goes back and tries to do this again or not remains to be seen. But as we've talked about, the government has had a checkered kind of history with some of these requests. There have been a lot of issues of privacy concerns, how much information should be available to the government, how much they can get access to. In this case, they are not getting access to this information. Again, we'll see if they try to make another run at it. But for the time being, the case is settled.
Interesting, because since Donald Trump was elected, quite a few government agencies seem to have been popping up with these alternative accounts, these rogue accounts like the Environmental Protection Agency and NASA and others. It's interesting that they're sort of going undercover to report what's going on.
Yeah, and it gets back to the issue of free speech. The government wants to find out who these people are, of course, because they don't want them leaking this information, but under the First Amendment, people have a right to share some of these things as long as they're not breaking the law and sharing anything that's classified or illegal. In this case, this account doesn't appear to be doing that, so there's no legal reason why they would need to reveal that information.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter @APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream @VOA_IE. And that does it for today's show, but we certainly thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FEWSNET, in 2017, some 70 million people across 45 countries will need emergency food assistance. Severe drought and economic instability are part of the problem, but so is violent conflict. Indeed, it's important to stress that these crises are largely man-made, with other compounding factors, said Matthew Nims, acting director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace. This is certainly true of South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen. Famine was declared in parts of South Sudan in late February, while Nigeria and Yemen are at high risk of famine. In South Sudan, the civil war that began in December 2013 as a consequence of the power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar escalated into a civil war. An estimated 5.5 million people, nearly half of South Sudan's population, will face life-threatening hunger due to this man-made crisis. In Nigeria, an estimated 5.2 million people will face severe food insecurity by June, particularly those displaced in Borno State. There are signs that famine likely occurred in 2016 and may be ongoing in parts of the state that humanitarian actors are unable to reach, said Acting Director Nims. The United States, said Mr. Nims, has provided nearly $386 million since fiscal year 2016 for people affected by the ongoing crisis in the Lake Chad Basin region. In Yemen, over 17 million people are food insecure, 7 million of whom are in need of emergency food assistance. Starting in fiscal year 2016, the U.S. government has contributed nearly $432 million in humanitarian assistance to Yemen, said Mr. Nims. In South Sudan, the United States has not waited for a famine declaration to intervene and will continue to respond robustly to save as many lives as possible. The U.S. is the single largest provider of humanitarian assistance to South Sudan, having provided more than $2.1 billion since the start of the conflict in December 2013. We remain committed to providing humanitarian assistance around the world as both a moral imperative and as a direct benefit to the well-being of the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.